Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. The new book, The Spymaster of Baghdad, is an account of wartime espionage, the true story of an elite top secret team of unlikely spies who came together against all odds to defeat ISIS. The book is by award-winning investigative journalist and former New York Times Baghdad bureau chief Margaret Coker. The book tells the story of ordinary citizens who make extraordinary sacrifices. The book challenges our perceptions of terrorism and counterterrorism, Iraq, and the wider Middle East, as well as American occupation and foreign intervention. Again, the name of the book is The Spymaster of Baghdad, a true story of bravery, family, and patriotism in the battle against ISIS. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Margaret Coker to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Really nice to have you on the program. I've long admired your work, and it's very nice to have you here. What brought you to want to write this story after a very long career, as part of a very long career as an investigative journalist, to say, okay, this is something that I want to focus a good swath of time on?
Yeah, well, I grew up in a military family, and we moved around a lot as kids. So I became used to, as a younger person, you know, telling stories about different places to my friends who had never been there. And that was the impetus for really like me getting into journalism as an adult. But I'm an accidental war correspondent. You know, it's not what I actually set out to do with my life. But I've grown up, you know, like so many of us, during the war on terror. And so just by virtue of the fact that those are the stories that are there to be covered most by American newspapers and American media writ large, I've spent a lot of my adult life in the Middle East. And, you know, I've enjoyed reading lots of books about written by American servicemen and women and American generals about the times and the challenges they faced serving in Iraq and trying to help that country since 2003. But I was also, you know, because of all the time I've spent there, I know a lot of stories about the Iraqis who themselves have been suiting up every day in defense of their nation. And I thought it was high time to tell the stories about them and put Iraqis back as central characters of their own history and their own nation building. So I went back to Iraq in 2017 as the New York Times bureau chief. You know, I had a chance to get behind the scenes with this elite spy unit and tell the tales, the secret tales that they of the operations they've been waging with the Americans and alone to keep us all safe from Islamic terrorism. So that became the nugget for my book.
At what point did you realize while covering it that you had a story, and a pretty cohesive one, in the sense of what this group was doing and how they were doing it?
Yeah, you know, when I was there in Baghdad for the Times, I actually wrote the first story about this this elite spy unit. I wrote it for the Times, and it was a front page story at the paper. You know, I went back to Baghdad after so many years of going back and forth, and I was really struck in 2017 about just how dynamic and how alive Baghdad had become. It was achieving this renaissance at a time when there were ground operations and a full-fledged war going on in the north of the country in the ground battles against the Islamic State. And, you know, I'd spent so much time in Iraq in the mid-2000s when it was known, like Baghdad was known as the murder capital of the world, and there were terror attacks happening multiple times a day, and people didn't know whether they would come home alive from work or when they sent their kids off to school. And suddenly Baghdad was a different place, and I just really wanted to know who had cracked that nut, who had finally been able to make Baghdad safe for families to be out at night and for nightclubs to be flourishing. And so that brought me into this long, winding journalistic quest to the doors of the spymaster of Baghdad and learning about the secret operations that he had been involved in was both thrilling and, you know, quite a privilege, because I was learning secrets and I also had this obligation, I think, to tell the tales of his men who, you know, in some cases gave the ultimate sacrifice, you know, on behalf of their nation, but again, also to keep us safe. You know, Islamic State was trying to destroy Iraq, but also, you know, destroy America at the same time.
You touched on this, but tell us about the spymaster himself and how ultimately you you came to hear about him initially.
Yeah, I love reading spy thrillers. You know, I'm a student of the Cold War, and you know, John le Carré is probably one of my favorite fictional novelists. The Spy Master of Baghdad. I mean, in real life, Abu Ali al-Basri is his name, and he's kind of the closest I've ever come to a real life George Smiley for people who know that le Carré character. You know, he's the guy who sort of comes to work every day, assiduously does his job and keeps the files on bad guys, but he doesn't crave the limelight, and he never really has, and never, you know, that's just not who he is as a person. So, you know, I come from a very middle-class family. You know, we are not a family with great men or great women of history, and I'm drawn to stories about other just middle-class people who do amazing things on behalf of their nation. And so I had a chance to, you know, bring these complex characters to life, you know, him and all of his hard work, his two officers, you know, two brothers who come from the wrong side of the tracks, from, you know, one of the like worst neighborhoods in Baghdad, who has suddenly had this chance as underdogs to become unlikely heroes. You know, it's all the stuff that, you know, that I think Americans can really sink their teeth into in terms of, you know, both compelling characters and thrilling tales of bravery. And it all happens to be true. And it doesn't really matter that, you know, these characters have names that are hard to pronounce, and most Americans will never eat Iraqi food, but they can get behind the struggle, because we all like stories of underdogs who do well.
So let us talk about the Falcons and this group that was put together by the Spy Master of Baghdad. As you mentioned, the brothers, the Sadanis, and where did they come from? Ultimately, the wrong side of the tracks, but they come from a really bad neighborhood in Baghdad. How did they come to the aid of the Spy Master and ultimately provide the backbone to the Falcons?
Yeah. In the mid-2000s, you know, as Iraq was trying to bring itself up from its knees and, you know, amidst the chaos, every single government agency had to be rebuilt from nothing. We know a lot about the efforts to rebuild the Iraqi military, because those are the kind of stories that American military officers have already published. We don't know a whole lot about the very important role of trying to rebuild the intelligence agencies in Iraq. And that is, you know, one of the cruxes of my story. You know, America chose some really bad partners at the beginning, and then finally found people who were trustworthy and both and good at their jobs, people like the Spy Master of Baghdad. And so when it came about to, you know, build a spy unit from scratch, you know, we have, you know, the adult in the room who's the Spy Master, and his very assiduous and careful recruiting to find, you know, a band of brothers on which that he could rely, but also who shared his vision of bringing a modern professional sensibility to a nation that had been run by secret police and torturers for two generations beforehand. And so the Sudani brothers themselves, the younger brother was, you know, is really the bright guy who did well for himself and, you know, achieved. He wanted to become an elite service member in the Iraq forces. And so he was the first recruit into this band of brothers. His older brother, who was a disappointment to the family for years and years and years, was sort of lost in life. You know, there's also this interwoven tale of these family dynamics and this family drama of how this older brother has a chance to redeem himself. And it's a tale of actual brothers, you know, looking out for one another and helping each other out through life. And then the band of brothers, as we kind of understand as Americans, you know, the tale of people who are defending their nation against all odds.
When it comes to this group, who ultimately are they working for?
Sorry, Joe, I had a bit of a fuzz through there. Can you
sure.
just repeat that question? I couldn't hear you.
When it comes to this group, who are they ultimately working for?
Well, they're ultimately, as Iraqis, they're ultimately working for themselves and their nation, right? I mean, they are patriots, and they answer to the Iraqi prime minister because they've been so successful in doing counterterrorism work and sort of the hard work of cultivating human intelligence sources who can help them both map out the networks of terror in Iraq and also flipping those people to make them double agents and learning more about these terror networks. The Falcons have been working with the Americans because for all of the high-tech surveillance and the amazing array of you know, big-ticket intelligence tools that the Americans have, you know, the Iraqis have home field advantage. You know, they right. most of the elite people, both in Al-Qaeda and Iraq, I'm sorry, the Islamic State, are also Iraqis. And so America has needed them as partners in order to understand the critical kind of social networks and tribal networks that these bad guys play in and control. And so, you know, it's all about proving yourself, like in any profession. If you have a string of successes, you get noticed. And the Falcons, through some early successes in the mid and late 2000s, got to be trusted by the Americans to help them with some of the most high value and you know, important counterterrorism operations of the last decade.
So trusted is the key word I take out of that sentence. So with that in mind, how would you describe the relationship that this group has with U.S. forces and U.S. intelligence officers?
Well, I think, there's not an American character in my story. I reserved all of my pages for Iraqis. But off the record, of course, and in the background, American officials tell me over and over again how trusted and how valued the Falcons have been in this fight against Islamic State terrorism. And, you know, the U.S. official history, the U.S. Army's official history of the war in Iraq doesn't mention them by name. Right. The operations that they've been involved in are there. And there's a generous interpretation of the Falcons, the vacuum of the Falcons in the official history books so far has been that the Americans didn't want to endanger their partners or endanger their relationship because it is a very fluid and risky situation politically in Iraq. History is always written by the victors, right? And so Americans have had their own reasons for burnishing their roles and their reputations in the way in which the Iraq war has been chronicled so far. And again, you know, for all of their amazing sacrifices and efforts that the Americans have made, it's high time that we learned more about the Iraqis who've been doing the same things, and most of the time together with the Americans.
And your book also, we're just about out of time, but your book also focuses on the other side of this, right? Of what goes wrong.
Right. It was important to me to be able to also bring in women into this this book, because Iraqi women do have play a large role in both professional and family life. And there was, one of the successful operations that the Falcons had was preventing a huge potential biological terror attack in the Capitol. And when I found out that the mastermind of this terror plot was a woman, I thought, wow, I've got to know more about her. What made her become a terrorist herself? And so, also finding her family, talking to her parents, and her interrogators to figure out how someone who on paper had everything going for her fell down a rabbit hole of online radicalism and decided to use her talents not for the good guys but for the bad guys was also one of these fascinating research projects. She's one of the main characters as well as in the book.
The book is fascinating. It is The Spy Master of Baghdad, a true story of bravery, family, and patriotism in the battle against ISIS. Margaret Coker, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program. Best of luck with the book.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Be well. Again, Margaret Coker, author of The Spymaster of Baghdad. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC Northeast Public Radio.
You say, I can't let that bother me. And how much do you say? I mean, do you live under a rock and just say, okay, I don't want to know about what they're saying. I just want to do what I'm doing. Or do you have to be aware?
Well, I have to say that being aware, it kind of cost me a lot of peace of mind because, you know, that's not everything that would be said about you would be kind or cool, because that is the nature of being exposed that much, you know. And sometimes it got to me, and sometimes it, you know, I just had to kind of like deal with it, and when the negative tide will come, I would just like put it on the side, you know.
When you got to Los Angeles, how much of, and what was the pressure to say, okay, I want to do what I was doing before, I just want to do it here?
Well, the thing is, when I'm doing it here, I have to be very, you have to be smarter, because you can't just say, hey, I'm going to do a political satire show like I did in Egypt, because here the market is already saturated. So here I have to find my own niche, my own space in my new country. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing other stuff. I'm using comedy. I'm doing stand up. I'm kind of like getting my own niche in the country, in this space, because I can't just like come. I have to live with the fact that I'm not gonna be as big as I was in Egypt, and I have to start from kind of a much lower level than I was. You know, I cannot just like expect that doors will open for me here in America when I come. Yeah, you had 40 million people watching your episodes back in Egypt. Good for you. But here in America, you have to start from scratch, and you have to push yourself in different directions in order to, you know, achieve a certain status. You cannot just like depend on what you did in Egypt and think that things will open up for you.
But at the end of the day, it comes down to happiness and joy.
Yes,
and you're pleased with where you are.
I'm happy that like I have a chance to reinvent myself at such a later stage of life. I'm almost 47, and I'm in the last 10 years, I kind of reinvented myself 3-4 times. I was a doctor, and then I became, you know, I did a YouTube, and then from YouTube did a TV show, and then I had to leave all that behind and come to America and try to reinvent myself in a new country with a new language, to a new audience, to a new different kind of performances. Now I'm writing a book to children in my second language. So all of these are, I think it's an incredible journey, and I'm very happy. I mean, sometimes there's always these feelings of uncertainty and fear that you're not going to make it. But the beauty of this journey itself, and trying to learn something every day and teach yourself something every day, I think it's priceless. And that's what I'm enjoying right now, kind of like the whole reinvention and the remaking of yourself.
Well, the book is just lovely. It is The Magical Reality of Nadia. It is out from Scholastic. Bassem Youssef, I thank you so much for spending time with us. What a great pleasure to speak with you. I wish you all the luck in the world.
Thank you so much, and I hope to be on your show again.
I look forward to it. Thank you very much. Again, Bassem Youssef is the author of the new book, The Magic Reality of Nadia. The book is published by Scholastic. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Support comes from Glove City Coalition, Gloversville, New York, working to promote healthy lifestyles through education and community collaboration. GloveCityCoalition.org. And from Gomez Neurology, Albany, a neurology clinic and infusion center providing care for neuromuscular disorders, headaches, multiple sclerosis. Now offering in-office EEG testing for epilepsy patients, GomezNeurology.com. For information.
This is the Composer's Datebook for February 25th. I'm John Burge.
Psst. Hey, buddy. Wanna buy a bridge?
No? Well, how about a clarinet concerto then? As most of us know, the Brooklyn Bridge is not for sale, but this New York icon has reputedly been sold to many unsuspecting visitors. After its opening in 1883, Harper's Monthly wrote, The wise man will not cross the Brooklyn Bridge in 5 minutes nor in 20, but will linger to get the good of the splendid view about him. The American composer Michael Dougherty did just that and came up with a concerto for clarinet and wind ensemble that premiered in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and then on today's date in 2005 was performed in New York's Carnegie Hall. Says Dougherty, "Like the four cables of webs and wire and steel that hold the Brooklyn Bridge together, my ode to this cultural icon is in four movements. East, Brooklyn and Brooklyn Heights. South, Statue of Liberty. West, Wall Street and the lower Manhattan skyline. And north, Empire State Building, Chrysler Building, and Rockefeller Center." In the final movement, I imagine Artie Shaw, the great jazz swing clarinetist of the 1940s, performing in the once glorious Rainbow Room on the 65th floor of the Rockefeller Center. Composer's Datebook is produced by APM, American Public Media, in collaboration with the American Composers Forum, reminding you that all music was once new.
Support comes from the Poughkeepsie Public Library District, presenting virtual and in-person story times for children, computer classes for adults, and art and gaming for teens. POKLIB.org.
All of our segments are available online at wamc.org/roundtable or via podcast. Find us on Facebook and Instagram at WAMC Radio and on Twitter as at WAMC Roundtable. Our producer is Sarah LaDuke, our engineer Mike Bowen. Thanks to our panel, Alan Chartok, Malia Dumont, Vera Carius-Kelly, and Ira Fosfeld. I'm Joe Donahue. Stay safe and stay tuned for Midday Magazine with Jim Lavulis.
This is Northeast Public Radio, WAMC FM HD 90.3 Albany, WRUN HD 90.3 Remsen Utica, WAMK HD 90.9 Kingston, WOSR HD 91.7 Middletown, WCEL HD 91.9 Plattsburgh, WCAN HD 93.3 Canajoharie, WANC HD 103.9 Ticonderoga, WAMQ HD 105.1 Great Barrington, WWES HD 88.9 Mount Kisco, WANZ HD 90.1 Stamford, WANR 88.5